I'm going to be drawing today on work from my current manuscript that I'm completing. And first, I just want to say that I am going to be using Latina with the at sign because gender is a major part of my analysis. You know, there's you know, debate about the X and the at sign, and I'm not using either of those. But then when I talk in the aggregates, just terminologically, when I'm just going to use Latina because why not, right? Okay, so I want to bring you into the scene a little bit. You know, this is one of the movements that the immigrant activists I work with took part in, which is for immigration reform, or what I'd like to call immigration justice. So this is Los Angeles, 500,000 people on the streets to protest draconian anti-immigrant bills like Sensenbrenner's. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. Educational justice, I'm going to explain what they're doing with regard to schools in a city like Long Beach, California. I tend to focus more on the environmental justice movement work that they're doing, but not exclusively. So just to kind of bring you into the scene and tell you a little bit more about it, if you look at this picture right here, that is the port of Los Angeles and Long Beach, and it is it is the largest cargo container port in the United States. This is how you and I are able to buy things, right? At Costco, Walmart, Target, Sam's Club, you know, cars, clothes, whatever, furniture, right? Now, the problem is, because of globalization, a lot of this stuff coming from China, of course, is that they're powered by diesel. Okay, and then what happens is that they're put on these, you know, 18-wheelers, right, that drive also to the various stores across the country. And then they're also put on trains, okay? And so there are rail yards next to the residential areas of these immigrant activists, these Latina and Asian immigrant activists. Now, these are also powered by diesel, okay? Then you have the other major source of pollution that these immigrant activists are fighting, which is the oil refineries, right? You can see here adjacent to their residential areas, okay? So New York, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey is actually the next biggest, right? So these pollution issues have also been, you know, fought against by activists in the local area and, you know, studied by academics. The issue of asthma, high asthma prevalence, is not just something specific to LA. Clearly in New York, that's also been a major environmental justice fight, okay? Okay, I just want to show you briefly the map. I'm sorry it's such a poor picture, but I'm kind of a tech dinosaur, so I screenshotted it. but it's better than nothing. So the communities that I'm mostly working in is basically this kind of industrial port belt right here. Do you see the port of Los Angeles, Long Beach, right? This is where all those cargo containers are coming in and taking stuff to the stores where we shop. But this is the area where you see a lot of diesel pollution. You see all these freeways, right? And the communities I'm studying are next to these freeways. But you also have a lot of oil refineries. Okay, so this just kind of gives you a sense geographically where we're at. Okay, so the main question that I want to explore today is, and this is something that the activists really foregrounded for me, but then, of course, I'm analyzing in relationship to scholar-activist debates. But why and how do embodiment and emotionality matter in movements that we wouldn't necessarily place those in, right? So environmental justice, immigration, and education justice. And what I want to do is also link this to the question of the broader implications for citizenship, right? What it means to be a good citizen. What does it mean to belong in this country, okay? And I think this is particularly important because, as we know, American nativist racism has been, you know, occurring since the beginning, but we are now at the zenith of nativist racism in our contemporary era under Trump's white racist nationalist administration. Okay. Okay. So what is the literature that I'm engaging? Where do I want to intervene and make a contribution? So one of the arguments I make is that in social science and beyond, we really need to be centering frameworks that are focused on nativist racism, or you can call them white racist nationalism, okay? I don't think that we've centered them. And I don't think we've centered them within the neoliberal context that is important. And here's why, okay? I gave a whole other talk about this at the ASA in Philadelphia recently, American Sociological Association, is that I think one of the mistakes we as social scientists made is that we really did not see the rise of Trump and white racist nationalism coming. Okay, I blame myself for this too. I am definitely not, you know, calling other people to the carpet. But I think one of the reasons we didn't see it is because we're so fixated on the white-black binary or the white-black order, and we're always just stuffing Asians, Latinas, you know, indigenous people into a framework that is really about white-black history, right, and what's going on now, that, you know, I think we just didn't realize how much the neoliberal kind of workings, right, meaning the loss of the social safety net, right, corporations just ransacking, and the gap between the rich and the poor, okay? So that's the material side. But I also want to talk about the discursive side, right? The power of neoliberal, like, disavowal of racism. Oh, racism, post-racial, right? The disavowal of sexism, right? Oh, we're post-feminist, you know? You know, that I think that that was really powerful, and if we had been able to center these nativist racist frameworks that mostly affect Latinas, Asian Americans, and Middle Eastern Americans, right, that I think we would have actually predicted this. So just like the brilliant James McKee critiqued sociology for not predicting the 1960s upheavals, right, by Black Americans in particular, I think we're in that moment again, okay? Now, this is also important because it shows me why class and class inequality mattered so much to the Latino activists that I worked with, okay? Which caught me by some surprise, right? Clearly the whole, like, illegals argument has been mostly racialized, right? White people, and then there's, you know, Mexicans, right, or Latinos, Latinas. But, you know, when the Latinos talk about the oppression that they think is overarching and cuts across all of their different struggles, they really see classism as primary, okay? And what I'm arguing today is that they really see this class subjugation as something that is quite embodied, not just by them, but by the privileged. Okay, and so I'm going to explicate that a little bit more. Because of the different U.S. transnational projects, I don't get to address transnationalism today, but because of U.S. transnational projects of colonialism, empire, war in the Philippines, in Pacific Islander nations, Southeast Asia, embodied racism is what the Asian immigrant activists tend to see as, you know, primary and mediating everything else, right? This is not to say that they don't see the other isms as unimportant. They just see them mediated, you know, by what they consider primary, classism or racism. Okay. So the main point I want to make here is how did Trump get elected, right? He got elected based on an economic message, right, that your guys' lot in life sucks. America is not great, right? Whose fault is it? It's immigrants, Muslims, refugees, okay? So we have to be able to make that nativist racism, neoliberal connection, okay? So we also need to address the body and embodiment, and what I argue is related emotional life, right? Because emotions are a form of embodiment, okay? Now, the reason I say that is because starting with the Enlightenment, there's been this mind-body split, right? But body and embodiment scholars are saying we can't do that. The mind is part of the body, right? And emotions are often shaped by what we think, our thought processes, okay? So emotional life, emotions are a form of embodiment. Now, one of the problems with body and embodiment scholarship within sociology and related disciplines is that it is mostly staying in the realm of the theoretical. So what I really want to do today is really talk about it empirically, right, and be able to kind of formulate new frameworks through, you know, studying and collecting data on this, okay? Now, one of the contributions that sociologists have already made includes the work of Arlie Hochschild, right? So she talks, in tour de force scholarship about emotional labor, right? And she talks about it mostly with respect to the consumer realm, right? For example, flight attendants having to elicit a certain emotional reaction from their customers in order for this sort of like capitalist relation to go well, right? Which is very gendered and racialized, obviously. We've also heard emotions come up in the social movement scholarship within social sciences. So now, you know, we have people studying social movements and saying that emotions are marshaled to recruit people into movements, to get them to stay, to get them to feel solidary, right? So, you know, this is definitely not something that has never been addressed. But I want to address it in a slightly different way. So the first one here that I outline is top-down power. I don't think that we study emotive structures from the top down very much. Even like Eduardo Bonilla Silva's, you know, theme for the American Sociological Association was feeling race. And a lot of his emphasis was on how people of color are impacted by racism and how it affects their emotional states, right? And how that affects their life chances, etc. And that is very, very important. But we also have to look at it from the top down, right? And what I'm arguing is that we actually need to see that the use of emotive structures, right? Because one of the things that all these scholars who study emotion show us is that they're social, cultural constructs, right? Emotions are not just this visceral, like, is, be, are, right? These are social constructs that teach us how to interpret emotions. It teaches us how to manage them. It teaches us, you know, how to use them or deploy them in some way, right? But what I want to argue is that we need to address the way that emotive structures are used to actually have power, to maintain power, okay? And the way that I kind of, I capture all of that in a framework that I'm not going to get to really fully explore today, but is part of my book, which is called Bioneglect, okay? The idea that when people use biopolitics, right, to harm a population, right? So a perfect example, for those of you who know Foucault, like he says that you have to let the margins, the other, you have to let some of them die in order for some of the privilege to live, right? That's like a perfect example of biopolitics, right? And one of the things I'm arguing is that, yes, and that often involves a dialectic of power, right, that hinges on emotive structures. Okay, that's just not something you hear in his framework, okay? The other thing that I argue is that we can also think about body and embodiment in relationship to citizenship. And I'm not going to go into this in depth right now, but one of the ways in which I saw it among my immigrant activists is really defining what it meant to be a good citizen by emotionally supporting your community, your disadvantaged, right, your community that's hit hard by, you know, all of these different forms of subjugation, okay? The last thing I want to say is that relationality is also always important when we're talking about body embodiment and emotions, because a lot of times these emotive structures are raced, they're gendered, they're classed, right? So gender is probably one of the more obvious ones, right, that comes to mind is that, oh, women are more emotional, as if men being angry is not an emotion, right? I mean, these are always raced, gendered, and classed. And so I want to address that today in my talk. The one thing that I do want to also say is I'm a little bit surprised that we haven't centered frameworks of body and embodiment. When you think about how we've described it for so long, right? We've described that, you know, one of the ways of dominating indigenous peoples was to scalp them, right? One of the ways of dominating black people was to mutilate and castrate them or forcefully breed them, right? One of the racist, ways in which Asian immigrants were treated at Angel Island was these racist health inspections of their bodies as if they were animals, right? The sterilization of women of color because of eugenics and hyperfertility fears. We can even talk today about the Black Lives Matter movement, right? Black Americans having to constantly surveil and police their own body movements because they can be interpreted in a way that will get them shot and killed, right? Body cams, that's a virtual body, right? So, I mean, we've described it for so long, but we actually haven't prescribed it, right? And we haven't come up with frameworks that lead our thinking on the topic. Okay. The last point I want to make is we don't study immigrant environmental justice and education justice enough. I mean, I just don't see a lot of this, despite how such mobilizations are really changing politics, both locally in the United States and on a broader scale. If we just focus on environmental justice, for example, I mean, I think like we could extrapolate that and talk about how, you know, within sociology and within the social sciences, we need to actually be centering issues of climate change and climate justice, right? I mean, you know, I don't think we can have any more alarm bells sounding off about the state of our world, right? Some people saying by 2040, I mean, the destruction from extreme climate, right? So, I mean, if this doesn't convince you, immigrant environmental justice, let's think about climate change and climate justice, okay? And the final point is we don't even have enough on Asian ethnics working in the immigration reform movement, immigration rights movement. I mean, Asian immigrants are a huge part of that movement, right? And as we've had, you know, new work show, 16% of Asians in this country are undocumented, and the population's, that's the fastest growing undocumented population, okay? All right, so I'm going to go through this pretty quickly, data and method. So these are the years in which I worked. You know, I'm always informally in the field, but formally. I did 3.5 years of ethnographic participant observation. I'm formally a community organizer, so I was able to bring that to this research. I'm not going to go into everything that I did, but the one thing that I'll say is that I went to a lot of socials, and that's because that is seen by these activists as just as political as going to a protest or testifying in front of the mayor or the state legislature, right? Okay. The second thing I did was almost 50 interviews with activists, leaders, some of them staff leaders, members, but also detached allies of 5 community-based organizations and 3 supplementary organizations. I'll just describe a little to you. Now, what's interesting, and partly this is because of, neighborhood and geography, is that the organizations mostly were ethnically homogenous, for the most part. I should say racially homogenous. So these organizations were mostly Mexican, immigrant, Mexican-American, but definitely there are other Latina ethnicities represented. A lot of these are based in Long Beach or Wilmington, which are predominantly working class Latina communities, a lot of unauthorized residents, okay? So this is LABACA, Long Beach Alliance for Children with Asthma, CPC Community Partners Council, CFOSI Coalition for Safe Environment, and then I work with some supplementary organizations, EYCEJ, East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice, SE Semillas de Esperanza, LIA, Latinos in Action, okay? The main Asian American organization that works on this in the industrial port belt of LA is called People's Corps. This is mostly a Filipina American organization. And they, along with these organizations above, they have environmental justice, immigration reform, school reform, but there's also other issues that they work on. So I just want to make sure I'm not, too myopically defining them. Communities for a Better Environment, some of you may be familiar with them. They're a little bit more well-known. They're a more multiracial, multi-ethnic organization. I mostly worked with their youth environmental justice program. So the final method I used was documents analysis, just analyze hundreds of pages of documents from agendas at meetings to presentations. Okay. I want to reiterate that the mostly Filipina organization, but it also had members that were Pacific Islander, Cambodian, given the Long Beach area, Carson area. They're mostly mid-middle class or lower middle class. They're mostly authorized. And as I said earlier, the Mexican, predominantly Mexican organizations were mostly working class and unauthorized. Okay. All right. So how did the activists show me that they were living an embodied classism and racism and therefore politically responding to that? Okay. Well, one of the first ways was the way that they defined embodiment, or embodiment kind of kept coming up as an issue. And so the first ways it came up is sickness, right? Which makes sense, especially if you think about the environmental justice component, the environmental, the disproportionate exposure to hazards, right? But I think the other one was really interesting was mobility. And sometimes the two, you know, kind of overlapped. And so what the constant refrain that these Asian and Latina immigrant activists would come to was, we're sick and we can't move because of the following reasons, okay? So poor air quality, that makes sense, right? So many of their children are stricken with asthma. Many of them have other respiratory diseases, and there is a high incidence of cancer, okay? But what's interesting about poor air quality is that in terms of their bodies, they also felt that it meant they couldn't move because they could not exercise outside. The air was so bad, okay? And, you know, if you can't exercise, then you just don't feel free, right? You almost feel imprisoned in your own body, right? Another way is they just felt that their cities, the way racially unequal urban planning goes, some of you know urban planning better than I do, but you know that their cities were not walkable, they didn't have any parks, very little green space. And so this relates both to embodying sickness and lack of mobility, right? Because if you can't exercise, you're not healthy. If you don't have any place to go, where are you going to go to? How are you going to be mobile, right? Another one was, you know, issues of physical and socioeconomic mobility, which I found really interesting. And so I think the socioeconomic mobility was more symbolic. But this was one of the ways in which they also kind of felt stuck and stagnant. So I'll go over that later when I flesh it out in an example. And then for the mostly Latina immigrants, of course, they felt like they embodied lost mobility or no mobility because of ICE, right? Surveillance, the threat of deportation, always looking over your shoulder. Clearly, they're not going to feel free, okay? One of the interesting quotes that I got from, this was an unauthorized Filipina who's second generation. She works in CBE's youth EJ program. And, you know, I thought this quote was so interesting because it really showed both the lack of mobility because of the omnipresence of oil refineries in her neighborhood, but it also showed the power of that omnipresence. So I'm just going to read this quote for you. It wasn't until high school, like, I started going to people's houses. I started hanging out with people, and, like, I would see that where they would live was right next to a refinery. Like, all, and she starts laughing, my friends lived next to a refinery. And I remember, like, it was frustrating. Like, as a child, I remember when they would flare. I actually believe that that's how you made clouds. And so both of us, I go, oh, really? We both start laughing. She said, I would look at them and tell my mom, oh, look, there's my cloud. Okay? So first, there's an issue of mobility here, is that she can't live in her neighborhood without bumping into an oil refinery. Okay? That people's neighbors are not people, they're oil refineries. Okay? And they're so omnipresent in Carson that they actually become nature. Right? That they are the reason for the existence of cumulus clouds. Okay, that's how omnipresent industry is, right? And one of the reasons why she's talking about flaring is because that's actually one of the biggest causes of toxic pollution. Oil refineries often have to release all these toxic, you know, gases into the air to be able to refine oil, okay? They're often doing it illegally because they do it way more often than they're supposed to, and they do it at the worst times of day, right? When people are outside or, you know, people are awake, okay? So that flaring is one of the big campaigns against these oil refineries, okay? Now, I want to use this example to flesh out that idea of, you know, embodiment as being lost physical and socioeconomic mobility. So, you know, this is one of the schools that the activist children go to. Do you see this is the school? This is the freeway. I mean, they're literally just, like, right on top of each other. Okay, that's an elementary school. Okay, so no wonder the asthma, right? And I want to just repeat what Yolanda said, and I'm going to use her English because I don't believe the way you speak English is indicative of your intelligence. And she says, my son go to the high school and it is neighbor to the gas company. And one time they had little explosions and it's very hard. My son has headaches and pain in the ears, so it's very hard. And I tell him, be careful when you see this. Don't go outside the classroom and explain to the teacher. This no good for me and no good for the students. Okay? So clearly you see here there's just lost mobility in the school because you're having explosions by the gas company next to where you're trying to study. Okay? A lot of times students can't go outside. And so some of you grew up in LA, you know that there were actually like smog alerts where you had to run in, you know, during really smoggy times of day. But you can imagine how bad it is for these communities that live right along the freeway, or they live right next to oil refineries, or right next to the port of LA, right? Next to the rail yards, et cetera, where all the diesel is being spouted. But there's this issue here, I think, of like a lost socioeconomic mobility, because one of the reasons why these immigrant activists, and especially the mothers, are so involved in education justice issues is because they see their ticket, right, to being able to have a better life in this country is through their children going to school and moving up, right? How can you have socioeconomic mobility if you can't study? Okay, so there's that symbolic loss of socioeconomic mobility as well. All right. This was also a really interesting vignette about, like, the relationship between sickness and mobility. And I would argue we could say, is it sickness versus mobility? Or is it, you know, somehow, like, the two are related? And the way that the two are related is that these immigrant activists, and in particular it's gendered because we're talking about the way mothers interpret these issues because they're often the ones responsible for taking care of the children. The way they have to make these really horrid choices, right? Okay, so this was from Mona. She's a white American staff leader of Long Beach Alliance for Children with Asthma. And she said, yeah, the community really educates us because when the city was going to build a school right next to the 710 freeway, for those of you who know, 710 is a huge freeway, lots of diesel, particulate matter, we immediately opposed it, of course. But shockingly, the moms told us, we have to have a school there because we have to have one within walking distance. Plus, then we'd have two that we can walk to. The other was Cesar Chavez Elementary. I never would have thought of that. So do you see here, the whole point of these immigrant activists organizing is to not have schools next to the freeway, right? But when they have this opportunity for a school and the only place Long Beach is going to build it is next to the freeway, they actually have to choose it because many of them don't have cars, right? That's another form of lost mobility. When you're impoverished, you don't have a car. And many of you know public transport in LA is terrible, right? So they have to make these like lesser of evil choices of, you know what, just we'll have to completely like sacrifice and have this school because at least we can walk to it. I mean, this is sickness and mobility, right? One of the other ways that embodiment came up, interestingly, and this was something that I was vexed by in the beginning because of my traditional understanding of organizing, right? Which is that, you know, oftentimes, and especially the women, would get together, you know, and this is despite lack of resources, despite lack of time, lack of energy, they would get together and they would really, you know, spend a lot of time, energy organizing on like, you know, these seminars, sometimes 2 weeks long, on how to dress, how to put on makeup, how to do your hair, how to present yourself. And, you know, I'm thinking like, you guys, we have like BP, Arco, and Valero, and Texaco, and we have the Port of LA and Long Beach to fight, and Caltrans, and like, should we be spending so much time on this, you know? I got the cooking healthy stuff together. I got the exercising together. I get all that, right? I mean, that's definitely related to their cause, but I was a little bit puzzled by how much time and energy was spent on the makeup hair. And, you know, but you just have to listen sometimes, right? You just have to, like, shut your own mind and open it up. And, you know, what they said was, well, one of the reasons, Nadia, that we're so discriminated against is because of how we look, right? And, you know, the reality is that we are going to the mayor's office and we are going to the state legislature in Sacramento. And, you know, we're around all these, like, people who have these middle-class norms of dress and professionalism. And, you know, this is also political, right? This is us being able to be convincing and compelling and kind of like subvert and invert the stereotypes of us, right? We may be poor, but we don't have to look poor, okay? And I think that's an important, interesting sort of form of embodiment that they were also emphasizing, okay? And so I really love one of the narratives that came from a second-generation activist. His name is Johnny. He's unauthorized Guatemalan ethnic, actually, and he's one of the leaders of the Communities for a Better Environment youth program, a very respected program. And it was often the second generation, because English was their first language, they often spoke in these very poetic ways about embodied community, right? That I'm a part of and I'm fighting for the embodied community. So let me just read his quote and then I'll sort of analyze it. Environmental justice is not an identity, right? People don't see that as an identity, like being Guatemalteco or Chicano, but to me it is. It has so much to do with where I live, where I grew up in the United States. Let me see here. That's why I hold environmental justice dear to my heart. EJ allowed me to do that without having to focus on just one identity. It's that I'm part of my community and my environment and my surroundings. They're all different. It's not just pollution. I can't take it away from me. Okay. I think what's so striking about this narrative is what he's essentially saying is that environmental justice is not the traditional identity politics we're used to, like race, class, LGBTQIA, right? But he says, but it is, right? And one of the things he says is so useful and beautiful about environmental justice as an identity politics is that it involves race, class, right? It involves citizenship status. It involves ability status, right? And he's like, so it actually, unlike, you know, the problem with other identity politics, it sort of brings in all these vectors, right, of social inequality. But the other thing he's saying is that I embody my community because I can't take it away from me, right? My community is me and I am the community. And one of the things he's also saying here is that, but I want to be clear, we're not just embodying pollution. We embody the beauty of the community, everything about the community, right? And one of the arguments I'm going to make is that emotional support of your neighbor is one of the things that they believe they embody in this community. So by defining themselves as this embodied community, really focusing on the embodied dimensions of this political fight, right? They're also drawing boundaries, right? In sort of the Frederick Barth sense, right? In that we're the embodied community and they're the embodied healthy wealthy, right? Or if you talk to the mostly Filipina activists, they emphasize race, the white healthy wealthy, okay? So it's important to understand that they really see the privilege of embodiment in relationship to the disadvantages, but of course the beauty of their embodied community, okay? Okay, so I want to now shift gears a little bit and talk about emotionality, right? Bottom-up and top-down structures of emotionality as also a way in which we're talking about embodied politics here, okay? And I write here gendered, race, and class because most certainly they are, both from the bottom-up and the top-down. Okay, so the first one I want to focus on is the emotional toll of marginality, sickness, and of just doing activism in the first place. So just like I told you earlier, the activists, the Asian and Latina activists, really wanted to focus on the emotional toll. They wanted someone to listen to them and really recognize the emotional toll of being subjugated, right? And this is despite, you know, model minority stereotypes for some of the Asian groups. They want to talk about the emotional toll of sickness, right, of being sick all the time. But they also want to talk about the emotional toll of having to do activism in the first place. They really resented that they had to do this activism, right? You know, just, you know, stop disproportionately polluting us, and we wouldn't even have to do this activism, right? The other way in which emotionality mattered, as I've addressed, is really redefining citizenship, not just as, oh, I can vote or I can run for office, but really redefining it as, you know, being a good citizen is emotionally supporting each other because this is really hard, right? Being marginal, sick, and having to do activism with the no time and no energy and no resources we have, it's really hard, okay? And I write gendered here just because I didn't hear the male activists say this as much as I heard the women activists say it. And in fact, you know, I did, more often I heard male activists talk about the emotional toll, but it was more the women that talked about it as well. Now, the third way I want to talk about emotion is as a political strategy. And some of you might be familiar with this if you've studied the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina or the maternal politics, you know, that you see in lots of movements, including other Latina movements in the 80s in L.A., Mothers of East L.A., for example. But, you know, emotions are necessary political because it's part of political strategizing, right? It doesn't mean that they're turning the faucets on and off and it's all robotic and they're not automatons. Like, clearly this It's they mean it, but they also know the value of their emotional delivery. Okay, so I'm going to be addressing that. I want to talk especially about top-down emotive structures as power. And I want to spend a little bit more time on this just because I don't really ever hear this, at least not in social scientific literature. You know, I can just throw the question out to you. What is the one emotion that the Trump administration is weaponizing when they separate parents from children? What is the emotion that they're weaponizing between parent and child? What would you guys say? Oh my gosh, is that too hard a question? Love, right? Love. I would argue that it's love. If families didn't love each other, what he's doing, right, to scare them away from coming to the United States wouldn't work, right? And so, you know, this is one of the ways in which I see this top-down emotive structure being deployed. And I think if we studied this more, we'd be able to be one step ahead, right? But the ways that I often see, you know, the structures, emotive structures I often saw in all my field work, I sort of distilled into these three: apathy, disbelief, annoyance, and mockery, and guilting, often via condescension. And I'll be fleshing these out. These are all interrelated, okay? And then I'll be talking about the dialectic between the two. So let me start off with a fieldwork moment where I actually saw both bottom-up and top-down emotionality happening, okay? Now, the bottom-up one was, again, the emotional toll, emotional strategizing, citizenship as emotional support. And what I saw from the top-down was apathy. Now, what is apathy? Apathy is the lack of emotive expression, okay? So I want to just give you a little bit of pretext, and then I'll get into Cindy's comment. So what this was that BP ARCO often has to renew their permit to operate as an oil refinery in Carson, okay? They don't always do the public meetings, even though they're supposed to, right, to get this permit renewal. And so People's Corps, the Filipina, mostly Filipina organization, had been sort of, you know, door-knocking, organizing the community to try to at least come and, you know, hold their feet to the fire and oppose this renewal of their oil refinery unless they made major changes with their flaring, etc. So what ends up happening is that after, you know, this panel of all men, I think they were all white. One of them may have been Latino. But, you know, they give these presentation modules basically saying, you know, BP ARCO is doing everything it's supposed to do. Cancer is within its allowable limits, right? Which is like that biopolitics I was talking about. Some people have to die to let other people live, right? So, yeah, the death rate of cancer is allowable. And so, you know, we should be good to go, right? So, and when the public comment period starts, an elderly Japanese-American woman walks up to the mic and says, "Look, my husband worked for your oil refinery his whole life. I'm not saying that you caused his cancer, but after he retired, he got cancer and he died." Okay? So I'm not saying you caused it, but I wonder, right? I mean, it seems coincidental, right? And the officials, their response was apathy. Right? They don't say, I'm really sorry for your loss. They don't express anything emotionally. They just say, well, you know, BP ARCO is abiding by its regulations. You know, cancer rates have actually gone down. Can you really prove that the cancer was caused by the oil refinery? Right? That's always their go-to. Like, how can you prove that it was the oil refinery that caused that? Right? How can you prove that it was these trucks that caused your kid's asthma? Right? You can't prove it. Right? That's their power, too. So, in response to the official's empathy deficit and their statistics, right, Cindy, who's a Samoan American teacher at an elementary school in Carson who works with People's Corps, she just starts yelling, right? And this was my first public comment. This is very early in my field work. You know, up until that point, we just had, you know, normal conversations. So, and she was screaming in the mic. And so I actually jumped out of my chair. And, you know, what she says is, I am so angry. I am so tired of being sick, of seeing sick children at my elementary school where I work. So she lists the ailments. She's like, I have asthma. These kids have asthma. I have fibromyalgia. All of us have constant bloody noses, right? And she says, you know, it's very possible that her husband's cancer was caused by all of this pollution. She turns to the elderly widow. I'm really sorry for your loss. Okay? So clearly the apathy I've already explained, right? But I think this response shows her emphasis, right? She has to start out by letting them know the emotional toll that the sickness has had on her and, you know, her students at school. Okay? But then she's also talking, when she, you know, says that to the Japanese-American widow who's just kind of standing up there, right? And no one's really addressed her, right? She's providing that emotional support that she and her other teachers and People's Corps have really prioritized as a major form of political organizing, right? That's a way that we are good citizens for each other. And you can see by virtue of her anger, I mean, you know, she was definitely viscerally angry, but she also knew the power of being that angry because up to that point, the officials were able to normalize that, you know what, it's just normative that people die of cancer. And they were able to normalize that by being apathetic, right? So one of the ways in which top-down power works is by normalizing and legitimating that sickness, death, sickness and death is normal, and your emotional outbursts are not commensurate, right, with what is happening. That's the way they self-legitimate, right? And so that's an important dimension of the power. Okay, I want to focus on the other dimension, which is citizenship as emotional support. Now, one of the other criticisms that these elite officials would often levy at the immigrant activists is like, well, you're involved in everything, right? Immigration reform. So really, you don't know anything, right? Like, if you're involved in everything, you don't know anything. And so Ceci, who's a longtime community activist in Long Beach, you know, I said, how would you respond to that criticism? And she said, oh, wow. Why can't I just focus on one thing? I'm going to tell you what I think about that. I can't focus on just one, for example, just on education, because Nadia has asthma problems, and I need to support Nadia to support air quality and contamination issues. There are also people who are in unauthorized immigration situations, so if I'm a citizen that can change the community, but gesturing towards our translator, Marta, Marta over here doesn't have her documents and isn't a citizen yet, then I have to help, okay? And I bolded this part because what she's essentially arguing and what was consistent with the larger way in which they did politics is that she's saying that when I support you, Nadia, because you have asthma problems, I'm actually also making sure that we're improving air quality and contamination issues. And what she means by that, even though she doesn't explicitly say that here, is that one of the signal ways that they recruited people into the movement and they kept people in the movement was by showing emotional support towards them when no one else would. Okay? That was the way they actually got people who were apathetic or like, I don't want to be involved. I don't want to sign anything. You know, I'm undocumented. That's how they actually pulled them into the movement. And so what she's saying is by supporting you, Nadia, when you're suffering from asthma, I'm actually going to make sure that you become political. We are actually able to fight the power. Okay? So there's a porousness between citizenship as emotional support and actually, you know, the movement. Getting the movement going, keeping the movement strong. Okay, so because she mentioned legal citizenship towards the end of her narrative, I do want to comment on this idea of you know, citizenship as emotional support versus citizenship as, like, you know, these legal rights that we get. And I think this is important to bring up because I do think it flies in the face of a lot of immigration scholarship and political sociology scholarship, political science, that really talks so much about, you know, immigrants are wanting to incorporate into, you know, mainstream political structures. They want to vote. And these Latinas say the opposite. They say something very different. So what they say is, do I need legal citizenship to stay here and thrive? Yes. Okay. Do I desire legal citizenship? Do I feel emotion or pride in having that status? No. Okay. Do I care about the vote from citizenship? Not really. Okay. And, you know, this might sound surprising. Maybe to somebody it doesn't sound surprising. But if you think about how much currency they put in local grassroots community politics and how much currency they put in supporting one another emotionally as what it meant to be a good citizen, something that they think most Americans have abdicated, right? They've just neglected, right? And they're remiss on that. And then when you think about for these unauthorized, Latinos and Oz, right? When you think about when they look at the state, what has the state done for them? The state has basically terrorized them, right? The state has not given them economic opportunity, and the state won't even give them good schools, right? They won't even give them parks, right? Parks are important to these people, right? So why would I care about being involved in electoral politics? What is it really going to get me? Now I want to focus more on top-down, and I'm going to go through some of these a little bit quickly. But here's an example of racist apathy, right? So we're getting into some of the intersectional dimensions of this. So this is from a second-generation Mexican-American activist. She said, "And I remember one time that I went to testify. One person in front, an official, walked out talking on their phone. Yeah, that was really rude. And when there was a community person who did not know how to speak English, they discriminate. It doesn't really matter whether you're Hispanic, African-American. It doesn't matter. If they feel they're not interested in something, then they show you. Some of them may say that, 'I'm here, I'm still listening to you,' but you can just tell by their body language that they're not interested." Okay. So not only is this an example of racist apathy, but I think it's really interesting how she actually put body language over their verbal language, right? That she's like, that's the truth. They're really just racist towards us and see us in a racist way. Sexist apathy was also common. Obviously, this is, you know, race and gender. It's against women of color. This is from a second-generation staff leader, Filipino, for People's Corps. And one of the things he says is, I think for the most part, they don't really listen to the Filipino women. I think especially if they're not speaking their language of business or just like their capitalist language. I think maybe women have a stronger tendency to speak more about, you know, business affecting my family, my community. It has a lot to do with organizing because you have to actually listen to the community and connect with people on a one-on-one basis. Whereas if you are a man in patriarchal society, that's considered a weakness, caring about people. Okay. Now, to get to one of the other emotive structures, I saw kind of this interrelation between disbelief, annoyance, and mockery. This is something I saw over and over again at public comments or protests or what have you. So this was a woman, unauthorized Mexican ethnic. She can't speak English. And she said, "Our pueblo," which is, you know, a really familial term for community, "our pueblo is speaking for what it needs. A lot of the time, the people who are supposed to be listening, helping the community, they listen and they just laugh." Okay, and some of this laughing actually just seems really out of place because this is after people have gone up. Some of them are crying. Some of them are talking about being cancer stricken. But you see a lot of, among the officials, you see a lot of shaking of heads, just annoyance, and actual laughing. Okay, again, though, it is normalized. Okay, precisely because of the way in which they kind of couch it in being more emotionally reasonable, okay? I want to now go over the last one, guilting. And often it came in the form of condescension. So this is at a meeting that deals with the expansion of the 710 freeway. So because there's such a huge increase of goods coming in from China and elsewhere at the port of LA and Long Beach, one of the busiest in the world, as I said, they decided to try to, like, widen it one lane one way and one lane the other way. And, of course, these immigrant activists were against that, right? And one of the things these immigrant activists were able to do was they were able to demand, a health impact assessment. The Latina activists were able to demand getting it in Spanish, in the Spanish language. So these are like minor victories, right? But the problem was is that the Community Advisory Committee, which is like, you know, the Metropolitan Authority of Los Angeles, basically, different representatives, they didn't give them barely enough time. And it's this huge document, right? And so the activists and the community didn't have enough time to read it. So, you know, they went up at the mic and the activists were complaining about this, you know, using varied styles of emotional delivery, right? And this was one of the ways that officials guilted these activists in the community. So a white male representative, he goes up and he says, come on, folks, let's talk about the real issue here, which is that the committee gave everyone plenty of time. The truth is that everyone procrastinates, including me. It is human nature to procrastinate. And that's why folks haven't had enough time to finish this, right? I'm sure no one opened up the EIR as soon as it came out. Okay, so everyone, like, slack-jawed, like there was a collective gasp, right? You know, people were disgusted. Some people went up to the mic and in English and Spanish, they went up there and they told him how problematic it was. And so, interestingly enough, one of the other representatives of the CAC actually said, say his name is Stan. He said, Stan, with all due respect, I actually agree with them that your comments are inappropriate. I think it's a real problem to tell them that they're procrastinators. I know you didn't mean it that way, but it does sound condescending. And Stan retorts, but I wasn't being condescending. I was talking about myself too, right? So one of the things about this, though, is besides the fact that he's assuming from a privileged, entitled white male standpoint that he knows everything about these people and he knows about their study habits, or reading habits, is the fact that, you know, he's basically completely dismissing their critique by trying to shame them as procrastinators, right? And it was incredibly condescending to the point where, you know, his fellow rep kind of plays good cop and says, you know, that's inappropriate, okay? I'm going to skip the next guilting incident. It had to do with an official basically telling them, you're not the only ones who get cancer. this didn't turn out normally, but that's okay. So now I just want to talk about the dialectic, the emotive dialectic between these people, these women of color organizers, and the these corporate and state officials that are mostly white male. What I argue is that this dialectic both affirms and contests systemic racism, sexism, and classism. And the reason why I want to say this is because I don't want people to just think, oh, well, emotionality is like just in the level of social psychology. No, it's not. I think it's institutionalized as part of these systems, okay? So if you think about it, and this is thinking about it intersectionally, if you have a passive or crying Asian activist, for example, you know, they can be, you know, they're affirming the stereotype of being effeminate, or these are just moms who aren't political. They don't know anything about politics. They're not entitled because they're acting so passively, right? The Asian woman is, oh, she's a passive model minority, right? If you look at a passive or crying Latina, the same thing, but one of the ones that I would point out is, you know, oh, this is working class deference to authority, right? If you have the angry Asian ethnic, okay, now we're affirming the stereotype of the dragon lady, right? The hyper-masculine dragon lady. And then, of course, the man becomes like the hyper-masculine patriarch, right, in the Orientalist kind of framing. If you have an angry Latina ethnic, you know, it affirms the stereotype of the fiery Latina, right? The machista man, right? Or typical working class, like, you know, they don't have habitus of the middle class or the upper class, right? They're just, you know, they're rough, right? But the important thing about this is that taken together, what this is doing is this is affirming the mind-body split that has worked so well for those in power, right? For centuries, which is the idea that people of color and women are always more embodied, right? They're in their body, right? Men of color, the mostly white male establishment is mental, right? We're rational. We're in our heads. Therefore, we're civil. We're not emotional, right? And that's why I say it's whiteness and maleness. And I think the way that it interrelates with the systemic aspect is that this kind of bifurcation, this dialectic of emotive structures, is exactly how they're able to justify their policy responses. Right? It's like, you know what? You guys, you're emotive, you know, you guys are out of line, you're unreasonable, or, you know, writ large, it's just affirming all these existing stereotypes that feed into institutionalized race, sex, and class, right? But we can justify our policy responses because we're calm, we're reasoned, we have science and technocracy behind us, right? And so it justifies what I saw over and again, which is doing nothing, right? Or they do nothing, or they give these minor concessions, like a shoddy Spanish translation of an EIR that they give them a week or two to read, okay? So, you know, it justifies and self-legitimates their form of power. Now, of course, resistance matters. I'm not saying it doesn't. So one of the things that I think makes these emotive strategy so powerful is that it does expose the empathy deficit of those in power. It is embarrassing for some of these officials to look like they have no empathy and they have a heart of stone when they have mothers next to children crying, people stricken with, you know, all kinds of diseases, mothers narrating like their blue-faced child, you know, bobbing in their arms, not knowing if they even have health care, they can afford it, you know, trying to get ambulances, not speaking English. You know, they do exploit that empathy deficit, and it does work, and they have eked out victories. I don't mean to paint an abysmal picture, right? The other thing is respect, right? You know, they have to at least respect these Asian and Latina and other people of color activists when they're angry, because it shows that we're not just going to sit here and be deferential or internalize our inferiority or our foreignness or our outsiderness. We're, you know, going to stick it to you. We're going to be assertive and aggressive and self-possessed. And so it you can kind of encapsulate it as, you may not respect what I say, but you'll respect me, okay? And so I do think those emotive strategies are powerful in that regard. Okay, so my conclusions and the research implications. So I'm going to bring back the contributions I wanted to make, and in red kind of really crystallize what I think the contributions can be, and hopefully go forward. We can sort of look at new research directions. So if we center, you know, racist nativism, or what now people are calling white racist nationalism, in its neoliberal context, I think it really helps us see, first, what I said earlier, why, you know, class capitalist inequality is so important, for example, to these Latina immigrant activists that I was with, right? They understand that, you know, that politicians use, you know, economic problems to scapegoat immigrants racially, okay? And, but they also recognize that this whole construct of legality versus citizenship is what's denying them economic opportunities. It's denying them SES mobility, okay? They know that the state is cutting Social Security, Medicare, cutting school budgets. They know, right? And so I think if we can really look at that linkage, we can understand, you know, how the Trump administration, you know, came to power, much to the surprise of many of us academics and probably even some activists, okay? If we look at top-down power with regard to body embodiment and related emotional life, you know, I want to emphasize again is that the powerful really need emotive structures to rule, to justify, to hegemonically normalize, right? To justify their policies, which mostly fall in the inaction category or in the concessionary category, okay? And again, I want to fit that under bioneglect. You know, I think if I asked, you know, if I could encapsulate what the immigrants would say, maybe using the powerful words of Roberta Flack, they would say they're killing us softly, right? And they know it, okay? Citizenship, right? When you think about body and embodiment, emotionality in relation to citizenship, and all kinds of citizenship, we realize that it makes a lot of sense that, you know, these immigrant activists would value embodied community or environmental justice as their identity politics, right? We would understand that voting, running for office, you know, whatever, having passport, whatever, is not as important to them as the ability to sustain each other and keep each other going through emotional support networks. Okay, and then, of course, as I said, these are always race, class, and gendered in some way, but we also have to see why and how one of these becomes primary. And one of my critiques of intersectionality, relationality scholarship is that I don't think we are good enough at explaining why sometimes, whether it's the top down or whether it's the bottom up, we'll look at one of these as primary and not always think about them intersectionally, even if they're experiencing them intersectionally. Does that make sense? So, you know, why is it that, you know, classism is so important to one and racism is so important to the other? Why does the top-down decide to emphasize race instead of gender? Like, we need to explain that better, okay? Okay, and we don't study, as I said earlier, we have to study more of these movements, especially Asian-American grassroots community mobilizations. I think one of the things that was so striking is that even though these activists are involved in multiple movements, especially because they're interrelated, is that the politics of embodiment and emotionality and redefining what it meant to be a citizenship and what it meant to belong in America was a through line, right? Despite all these nuanced differences between the environmental justice fight, the immigration reform fight, and school reform fight, okay? So if we listen to them and we understand the way that they're changing politics, I think that we can predict the next power move from the top down. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. Yes, one of the fronts that they're fighting is, you know, trying to make sure that there's better access to fresh fruit and produce, right, in their neighborhoods. That hasn't been as emphasized as these other movements, just because I think that they see like the issue of asthma as more immediate, just because, like, you know, ailments due to food is something that takes a really, really long time, right, to kind of manifest in the body. But these kids already get asthma by the time they're like one or two, right? So that's why their emphasis is more on that. But I also think that because they're like, okay, we have to kind of really discern where we put our time and energy. So if we're going to work on environmental justice, health justice issues, then if we also work on immigration reform, we can work on broader issues that would give our immigrant communities more rights and resources that hopefully address not just food deserts, but address gang violence, making sure there's programs for youth, and we don't have the school-to-prison pipeline, right? And getting rid of, like, you know, sex work and, you know, whatever, in their community, right? Theft and all that. So there's lots of stuff that they have to deal with. Now, the only reason I bring up the controversial nature of quote-unquote food deserts is because Dorcida Taylor is one of the renowned environmental justice scholars in sociology. And one of the things that she says is that she actually thinks that we've underestimated not just the types of places from which immigrants get food, but their resourcefulness around it. So, you know, she says, you know, immigrants will figure out ways, or people of color, African Americans in these low-income communities, will figure out ways to, like, get a car together, a bunch of people carpooling, and they'll go to a farmer's market together. Or they'll start building, you know, community gardens have become another big thing. You know, they do go to these green grocers, or they go to the convenience stores has, you know, they have some fruit and vegetables, right? And so she's sort of arguing that she thinks a lot of white American scholars have kind of imposed, I don't know, I guess like a food desert type of conceptualization onto these inner city communities of color, and not kind of seeing the specific differences or the specific ways in which they actually are able to get produce. That said, a lot of scholars would still argue, and these are people of color scholars, would argue that for sure there's definitely not equal access when you compare it to, you know, more affluent areas, and that there is a higher incidence of illness related to unhealthier food, right? And the preponderance of fast food joints and, you know, because nobody wants to set up shop there, right? And so, yeah. So I think they see that as something that will be addressed indirectly, right? But that's not, I think they really want to do whatever they can to try to decrease the particulate matter in the air and try to get these trucks, trains, cargo containers on electric fuel completely. I think that's their biggest goal, right? So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Angie, former Thomas Tam Fellow.
Thank you so much for this very powerful testament to not only what they're experiencing, but how body emotions is working, which I really think has a lot to do with what's going on in politics. And
yeah.
In fact, it made me think, too, maybe not in this context, but another form of top-down emotional strategy would be anger, like self-righteous
yes.
anger.
Yes. Yes.
Particularly came out in not only Trump, but Kavanaugh.
Yes. Yes. Most
so,
definitely.
I really appreciate your talk.
Yeah.
I do have a question.
Yes.
This is actually not the topic for your study, but I was wondering how we might apply it.
Sure, sure.
Did you read Arlie Hochschild's work on rural whites in New Orleans?
I didn't.
Because okay. She approaches it through emotion work, and I was trying to figure out how poor and working class whites in rural areas would fit in this either bottom-up or top-down structure because
yeah.
In some ways they are race privileged, but they're also experiencing a lot of the same environmental classism and pollutions, and she kind of talks a lot about that. Somehow they don't make that connection between what they're experiencing and this larger power structure they're supporting. So I was trying to figure out where they would fit in this, you know, one or the other. They're kind of in the middle. And it's also interesting that Trump and others have used anger and frustration and resentment and kind of manipulated it against those at the bottom. So I feel like they're almost kind of in this weird third dimension in the middle, but I don't know if you thought a little bit.
No, that's a really good point. Are they fighting against kind of the neoliberal neglect, like the loss of the social safety net, or is it more just specifically environmental
recollection,
injustice?
It wasn't even about them fighting.
They were experiencing
all of this.
Oh, okay.
Stories of how
yeah.
they were experiencing it.
Okay.
And they couldn't make that connection that it was the result of a lot of these policies from, you know, political parties that they're supporting.
Right. Yeah.
It's a little bit of a complicated... Probably have to read it to
yeah, answer, yeah. No, the reason why I ask you is because there is actually a lot of work on how, you know, the white working class or impoverished whites are, actually struggle with a lot of environmental justice issues, right? I mean, of course, if you look at the overall EJ literature, it's race that actually determines most where, you know, things are cited, where all the pollution goes. And so whites are definitely privileged vis-a-vis blacks and people of color, but that doesn't mean that, you know, whites, especially lower-income whites, don't face environmental hazards disproportionately, too. You know, what I think is interesting is I think from what you're saying, and I should read the work, but I think from what you're saying, I think one of the reasons that they don't recognize that these policies are actually causing their communities to be made sick and their bodies to be made sick is because of race privilege. I think it's because of whiteness, right? Because the idea is that even if these Latinos, like, they kind of see racism mediated by classism, they still are all, racism is always on the mind, right? And I think if racism was something that was front and center for, if they were experiencing racism, they would immediately be able to be like, yeah, of course, right? That's why, you know, they put the toxic incinerator here and they contaminated the water here and built the chrome plating factory and oil refinery. They extract oil. They do it right here in our neighborhood. But I think it's race privilege that doesn't allow them to see that. And if we think about it from the top down, you know, and this kind of goes back to the intersectionality comment I made is that, you know, even though it's in poor whites' interest to join forces and ally with people of color and working class people of color, they often don't, because the way the top down always constructs the discourse and the argument and the pitting against each other is on racial lines, you know? So, I mean, I want to read it and I want to, you know, be able to, you know, think about it more, I guess, specifically, but I wouldn't be surprised if those dynamics are going on, right? And when you look at the environmental pollution against white communities, They'll only talk about class. I mean, that's the only place they'll go, right? But they won't think about it intersectionally, or they won't, you know. I mean, obviously they're not going to talk about race. But if we think about class also, if they're working class whites, we might want to think about norms of working, like working class norms, right? Is it deference to authority? Is that also going on here? Is it not questioning authority, right? Is that possibly, you know.
And she also cites
Oh, religion, yeah, yeah. Are they hyper religious, like Christian, evangelical Christian, or?
I don't know if most of them are.
Okay, okay, okay. Well, it is. It's really interesting. I mean, do you hear how the power elite says the reason you got that hurricane, the reason you experienced devastation in your community was because you were displeasing to God? I mean, that's like one of their lines. That's one of the, you know, that's. You know, like, okay, you know, that country experienced, like, you know, a tsunami. Well, it's because they're not Christian, they're Muslim, you know. So, I mean, I do think the politics of religion and the way it ties to emotionality is, like, also really, really powerful, you know. So, yeah, Min.
Yeah, actually, your point that racism... and nativism mixed there.
Yes.
It's well taken, no?
Thank you.
Yeah, really, Asian immigrants, and particularly undocumented, have a lot of problems.
Yes.
I feel for second generation, much, much easier. No?
You mean for the Latina second generation?
No. Asian American.
No? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a problem with your emphasis on class.
Okay.
How you can put Asian American and Latino together in terms of social class. I don't know. You interview there. How many Asian organizations? You talk about Filipino and Cambodian.
There's one organization that is predominantly Filipina, and then Communities for a Better Environment is Asian and Latina, and some Black.
But particularly Korean and Chinese community well organized in New York City. When I see, they do very well in taking care of immigrant undocumented. So, you know, when you put Asian Latino together, huge class difference.
I mean, there is a class difference, but that's the point. I want to compare them precisely because of their class differences, right? I want to see. So I didn't talk about this in my talk today, and this is from a larger book that's like many chapters. So I understand if there's not contextual clarity. But one of the things that I'm analyzing is both the similarities and differences because of this class difference, right? So we have mostly middle class Asian activists, right? We have mostly working class Latina activists. But you do have a sprinkle of working class Asian activists, and you have a sprinkle of middle class Latina activists, right? But yeah, the majority. And one of the things that I'm actually looking at is that I want to know if they approach these movements differently precisely because of their class status. And one of my findings is that they do, right? So one of my findings is that it's partly because Asian Americans are, most of the activists are in the middle class, that they actually don't emphasize class as much, right? And, you know, so there's all these other factors like the transnational connection to their home countries, et cetera, where they're reminded of race and ethnicity all the time, right? But one of the things that I also want to argue is that it's precisely because Asian Americans, because of their middle class status, are usually interacting with white America, whereas the Latinos are much more segregated. And they have to be because many of them are undocumented, right? So they're not going to want to always be within, you know, the institutions of white America. It's precisely because of that that also Asian Americans are able to kind of like not emphasize class in the way that Latinos do, right? Because when they butt up against white America, they experience a lot of racial discrimination, right? So even though they're middle class, okay? So, you know, I'm actually comparing them based on those differences. The similarity is that they're both activists for similar causes and similar movements, and they both live in that same industrial port belt of LA, right? The other similarity they have is that they're both racially foreignized, right? So the Asian Americans, the Asian immigrants are not seen as American because they're seen as, you know, you're linked to your Asian nation, but you are not the white person that we think of when we think of authentic American, right? The Latinos also face that, but they also are racialized as illegals, right? So I also kind of want to tease out, although they're similarly foreignized racially, I want to tease out those differences. And actually, it's teasing out those differences that gave me some of the most interesting findings, you know? So, which I didn't get to really expand on today, but I can talk to you more. Do people have other comments, questions related to your own work or trying to figure out how to further your own project? Yeah, Vivian.
Yeah, so thank you so much. Mm-hmm. It was really wonderful.
Thank you.
Living right now.
Yes.
What would be your recommendations based on this research for how ordinary folk in everyday life can mobilize? Is there something particular that they can do to come together? Specific about living next to an oil refinery? You know, I'm not, this is not what I do, so
I'm not as familiar.
But certainly I am familiar with apathy.
Right, yeah. You know, that's the million-dollar question. It is a great question. You know, one of the things that I think all of us could be doing, and, you know, I know that, you know, these immigrant activists have also inspired me to think this way, is, you know, I think sometimes we don't... I think especially among scholars, I think we sometimes have our vision of our answer first and then we fit the data to that. But if you, and it, I mean, this project, it took so much time, right? And it was definitely, it makes everything delayed, like this book. But I realized in like really taking this time to be amongst them, like, all like, even like the social movements work and, you know, the sociology of immigration, it's all about like, let's incorporate these immigrants. Let's incorporate these immigrants, right? These immigrants are assimilating and we're on this upward trajectory. And, you know, they're like, I'm not going to be that interested and involved in electoral politics, you know? Like, what has the state done for me lately, okay? Essentially my community is the only thing that makes me feel human and like I can continue. And so I think, you know, if we had sort of like spent more time with them or listened to them more, you know, I think we would have stopped saying like, oh, they want to assimilate and oh, they're already assimilating. And we would have said, you know, like, how do you think we should fight the power, right? And I think one of the things they would have said is like, look, I want you to expose the elite's like contradictions. I want you to make clear, like one of the things that they would say to me is that like, look, none of them listen to us. So hopefully through your research, like you can expose the way that they treat us in these comments, in these meetings, the inaction, the justifications of policy through these, you know, apathy, right? Mockery, whatever. And, you know, I think like they would say, look, we want you to expose them and the workings of power. So one of the thoughts that it sort of conjured up in me is that, you know, I think one of the things we've been trying to do is humanize immigrants, right? You know, and I a lot of us, and I can sort of, you know, sort of identify myself as sometimes falling prey to this, is that we're like, they're good for the economy, right? We follow this like market citizenship logic, which I think is very problematic, right? You know, it's like, it doesn't matter if they're good for the economy. They have a right to be here. There are plenty of people that are American citizens that are not good for the economy, right? Plenty of Americans, way more Americans commit crime than immigrants. It doesn't matter, right? And the idea is that it's not fully working to humanize immigrants. I think we need to expose, kind of inspired by them, the contradictions of the powers that be, right? So Trump is like, you know, I mean, he's weaponizing the love between parent and child and within a family, right? Why don't we say, what happened to family values all of a sudden, right? What happened to the culture wars? I thought the family was the end-all, be-all of the American nation in the future. All of a sudden, the family doesn't matter one bit, right? Yeah, go ahead.
That's a great
idea. Yeah. Yeah.
Very helpful.
Yeah.
But you're right. But that's a narrative that's been with us for decades.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
You think about the welfare
mm-hmm,
to work
mm-hmm,
reform
mm-hmm,
that was
right.
pushed by Clinton.
Right.
I mean, it was exactly that time
right.
that, you know, upper middle class and middle class moms were saying, we're opting out. We're going to stay home with our kids
mm-hmm.
and, you know, be with our kids, and the family is so important.
And then they made, yeah,
and
the working class
and,
women,
know,
yeah.
Right. And then mm-hmm. they were demonizing
right.
black and brown.
Right, right, right.
Poor
moms. Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is then how do you interrupt the cycle?
Yeah. Well, I think you start locally always, right? And, you know, I think as much as they can still kind of, you know, cyclically legitimate in action, or that, you know, they do throw bones here and there, and there have been more major victories. Like, one of the reasons, so what ended up happening with the 710 expansion is that they decided to punt it. They're actually, after years and years of seeming like it was going to go through, they didn't do it. Now, that had a lot to do with these activists that I just talked to you about, right, and the pressure that they imposed on Metro LA, the board, etc. So, you know, one of the things that I think these elites are realizing is that even the unauthorized are political agents that we're going to have to contend with, right? And when we do these big meetings, or there are these big protests or these public comments, there are a lot of people there. There were some public comments where there were, like, you know, more white Americans, there were professors, there were academics, like, going up to the mic and being like, the way you're treating these communities is ridiculous, right? The EIRs that I couldn't even understand, and I have a PhD, right? And so, you know, they recognize that, you know, this is a political force that we're going to have to contend with, right? If they can go out in the streets in to the tune of 500,000 people, you know, we're going to have to start recognizing. And I do think it's, you know, because of the work of these activists, yeah, they're starting to get air filters in their schools. They're starting, for the longest time, schools didn't even have air filters. You have the freaking biggest, one of the biggest freeways, like, right outside their window, right? And, you know, they're realizing, like, you know, we've really moved away from the era of Pete Wilson and even Arnold Schwarzenegger in terms of, like, immigration protections, like, in L.A. and in California. And we have to, you know, pay homage and give credit to these activists that have been fighting on this front for so long. And so I think as long as whatever local, you know, whatever cause, like, that we actually take up, you know, it's always going to connect somehow in some way, shape, or form to what's going on from the top down, you know? So I don't know. I don't know. I think that we have to start there, because otherwise no one knows where to start, right? And then you move and you progress forward through that local entry point. Yeah.
If I could just contribute.
Yeah, yeah, sure,
because I actually reflected on that question in mm-hmm, recent speech, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I don't know if I have the answer, but mm-hmm. I almost feel like part of the effectiveness of Trump was his ability to use emotions.
Yes.
And, you know, negative
yes.
emotions.
Yes.
Also dehumanize all the
yes.
contradictory words, he harnessed anger and frustration, but he also dehumanized the people he was attacking.
He harnessed anxiety,
and
too.
Anxiety,
yes,
yeah.
Anxiety, big time, yeah.
So I almost wonder, like, you know, if I reflect on my own evolution politically and my involvement
yeah.
over the past few years,
yeah.
I feel like emotions was what really drove it, right?
Yes.
My ability not only to feel for people who are like me, but sympathize or empathize with people who are not like me.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
part of it was seeing these constant images,
mm-hmm.
seeing what they did to families, and, you know, even if they were much more disadvantaged than me, recognizing my privilege and my ability to use that to help and motivate myself through these emotions. So
mm-hmm,
I do wonder
mm-hmm.
if that actually can be a tool, too,
yes.
in many ways.
Yes, yeah.
You know, that's, I don't think it necessarily has to be a negative thing. I do think self-care is part of that process, though. I do think it's overwhelming.
Yes, yes, which they clearly do.
Right.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, these activists, if you even look at, like, who voted in a lot of these elections, a lot of them were minority, like African-Americans.
Yes.
In some of these mm-hmm. elections, right?
Mm-hmm. When they could vote.
So they're all doing stuff.
Yeah.
How do we get people
suppression,
yeah.
Yeah. yeah. That's how we got
how
elected.
How do we get mm-hmm. that, the larger white society to mobilize with them. Because if we look at the statistics, it's very split among whites.
And so
I feel like there has to be some kind of structure of empathy or something that
And I do think empathy works. I mean, look at how powerful it was for the civil rights movement, right? Look at how powerful it has been for DACA and Dreamer movements. I mean, definitely the empathetic discourse, the empathetic frames are definitely being used, I think, you know, to pretty, you know, substantive success. I do agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, and these activists would absolutely agree with you. They say we use emotions and we use emotional strategies as a way to shame them or get them to care, or at least a modicum of care, you know, to actually appeal to the wider public the way that, like, they did in the civil rights movement, maternal politics for the Argentinian mothers, etc., right? Like, they definitely are using that, and I think to really great effect, right? That, like, I'm not going to be a doormat or a jellyfish. I'm yelling at you because you're doing wrong, right? And I'm going to let everybody know that, right? And so I think in terms of, like, wider white America, I mean, I do think, I have to think, and I do believe, and there's just some, like, some informal data about this, that the caging of the kids, you know, the deaths of some of those kids, the splitting of those families, that had to have some impact on reasonable, moderate white America, right? In terms of women, I've seen some studies, and I don't know, maybe some of you guys know this better than I do. There have been women that have been turned off by this Kavanaugh case, that there's some, maybe some evidence of some trends of women kind of starting to question their membership in the Republican Party because of what they did to Christine Blasey Ford, Ramirez, etc., right? And in general, just the discourse, I mean, it's just awful. And Trump, I mean, you know what? I was actually kind of glad he mocked her at the rally because, honestly, if anything's going to get some of these moderates to realize, like, this is gender violence, right? I think it takes that kind of stuff, right? And so sometimes it's like, let him just rip, let him go, you know, like it might convince these people. But I also think, and it kind of goes back to what I was saying to Vivian, is that I don't think we scholars and scholar activists have done a good enough job of being on the offense and exposing all their contradictions, like, and really explaining what happened, right? We focus on the immigrants that are here, and then we're like, oh, we need to get rid of them, deport them, they're MS-13, you know, cage them, whatever. But we need to say, why did the immigrants get here in the first place? It's because you guys, through neoliberal globalization, through the constant, like, you know, project of war, right? That's the reason they have to come here. Because of all of your environmental destruction, these are climate refugees. They have to come here, right? Like, we need to expose, like, that Trump and his people and, you know, the United States is the reason they had to, and other first world countries is the reason they're here in the first place, right? And, you know, through that, maybe show white America. You think that, you know, these immigrants are stealing from your pocketbook, right? Look at this gap between the rich and the poor. Look, you know, like, Pfizer paid no taxes, right? Amazon was getting away with, like, you know, their workers sleeping in cars, like, you know, and Disneyland workers sleeping in cars. And, you know, like, we need to be able to kind of link that, right? That history, that geopolitics of, like, why immigrants are here in the first place. But also that, you know, it's these same companies, it's the same Wall Street, right? It's the same, like, military industrial complex that's raking you guys, right? That's why there's wage stagnation. That's why the gap between the rich and the poor is widened, right? They don't care about you. And I don't know how to do that exactly. Maybe some of you guys have ideas, but, you know, I do think that is not a strategy that we've gone in full force. Does that make sense? Like, I just feel like, you know, maybe a New York Times op-ed. Like, maybe we need to get out of the New York Times, you guys, you know? Like, just, I don't know, you know? It needs to be sustained, thorough, and full force. We just haven't done it, you know? And I'm not saying that we have to do it all and that it's this big thing that we achieve in one night, you know, but I think that each of us doing our part makes up the big puzzle, right? Makes up the big picture. Right? And I'm definitely blaming myself as well. So, yeah.
Hi, everyone. My name is William.
Hi.
Thankful for your talk. Mm-hmm. I was hopeful that I might hear in the grassroots group?
Yes.
if they would be more diverse and more heterogeneous. For me, I think just what I want to look for first before looking for goal is, are there any groups, institutions, classrooms where you see a good collection of like, between race or between cultures?
Definitely. They do work in a loose coalition, and it's much more diverse than what I shared today.
So I wanted to that because it's been very, very difficult for me to find out in like in schools and colleges in groups.
Yeah.
What do you do to find, or what are the conditions where you might find more groups like that, where they are working together rather than siloed? Because that's what I'm...
So you think the college campuses are siloed?
Just as an example, like if I were
to okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You always find, not always,
yeah.
In my experience,
mm-hmm.
divided by racial groups,
mm-hmm.
really good work, come together.
Mm-hmm.
I was very interested to hear if there's anything you experience about the conditions or how to put together a coalition of people who will first listen to each other's different cultural upbringings.
Mm-hmm. There's actually, I mean, there's lots of examples of that. And historically, I mean, there are lots of examples of that, right? So, you know, in the 60s, even though there was like, you know, the Black Power movement and the Red Power movement and the Yellow Power movement and, you know, Brown Power, Brown Berets and things like that, there was definitely still like, you know, different racial and ethnic groups like working within, you know, each of these movements, right? So even like the Black Panthers had like an Asian member, they had a white member, right? Like, so there are, I mean, those are more kind of the famous examples, right? And so you want to know how we do that?
Well, other than like, because that's the exception, right? You have like one or two.
Well, no, what I'm saying is that even in those larger movements, there were larger contingents of other racial and ethnic groups working in those movements, right? So it wasn't just one or two. It's just I shouldn't have given the Black Panther example, but I'm talking about famous movements. You know, one of the things about, at least in this example, is that if the communities are more homogenous, like, you know, first of all, LA has a lot of Mexican immigrants, okay? And the communities that they're living in are mostly Mexican. So clearly, their groupings, organization, especially since it's based on their residences, right, is going to be largely Mexican. But one of the reasons I love Communities for a Better Environment is because they have a Northern California office, they have an office in Huntington Park, which is like South LA, and then they have this, you know, office in Wilmington, which is who I was working with more, because it was in the port industrial belt I was talking about. You know, it's definitely more multiracial and multiethnic, and the reason for that is because, you know, first of all, you have communities that are, you know, in these areas, I think you have a little bit more diversity in the communities, right? You have racial, ethnic diversity, and so therefore you have more within the political organization. But it's also because some of these organizations really prioritize bringing in seasoned community organizers and seasoned activists. And so CBE tends to do that. And some of them come from the 60s. And so their staff and a lot of their philosophies come, you know, from working in various racial and ethnic or racially ethnic related movements. And so their, you know, their offices tend to be more racially and ethnically diverse, right? So the thing with the more homogenous Mexican immigrant activists is that many of these people are kind of newer activists, right? There's also the issue of language, right? A lot of them don't speak English, and so you have to rely on, you know, I mean, one of the things that they're actually saying is that we do want to have more diversity. Now that we kind of have this activism and political thing down pat, we want to get more people into our meetings. And one of the reasons they realized they could do that was to have Cambodian translator, right? Was to have, you know, other ethnic languages represented at their meetings. So if we're thinking practically, that is one of the practical issues we really have to deal with is language, right? Especially if we're talking about immigrants, right? And the thing about Asians is that we have, what is it, like 50s? I mean, it's like we have so many different ethnic groups, and then there's so many different dialects, right? So, you know, of course there's dialects within Spanish as well, but, you know, they can understand each other for the most part. So that's less of a challenge. But, you know, a lot of times when the movements, especially they gain momentum and media attention, you have other organizers of other racial and ethnic groups coming in and actually working with them. So that's another way that it's happened, that there's been coalition work.
That's really good. Maybe I'm not looking for the right places, but in the city you can go to very diverse.
How about, have you engaged with any of the immigration rights movements, immigration justice? I think you'd find a lot of diversity there, especially in New York. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the names of all the organizations. I'm very L.A.-focused, but, you know, I mean, there are a lot of black immigrants in New York, right, not just Asian and Latino, from all, you know, representing many different countries. And some of the people who are here earlier tonight, they actually look at, you know, the undocumented student population in the CUNY system or in other New York school systems, and there is so much diversity. Yeah, so I think that might be a place to start. Yeah. Do other people have questions, comments? They want to talk about their own work? Yeah, go ahead, Sung-Chun.
Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Do you have a transnational dimension?
I do, and it was actually the third part of the talk. It was embodied, emotive, transnational politics, and then I had to lop it off because it was just taking way too much time. But, okay, do you have a specific question? You want to hear about it? Okay. So the way that the transnational dimension came in, and this was actually it's in partial response to Min, is that when you look at, so I really wanted to understand, like, even though Latinos and especially Mexicans are so racialized, ethnicized, like, why was classism, and specifically embodied classism, so important to them? And then, you know, I wanted to understand why the Asian immigrant activists led with racism or ethno-racism first, right? And I found that transnationality was so important to that, right? Because if you think about the form of subjugation that these Latina immigrant activists have experienced in both nations, it's classism, it's poverty, right? So when you look at their status in Mexico in particular, prior to coming here, they were the dominant racial group. So racism or being a racial other was not something that was on their mind. If we think about different racial discourses transnationally or globally, in Latin America, race is harder to talk about. It's not as overt. It's only discussed maybe in times of like really egregious or extreme forms of discrimination and oppression, unlike in the United States, right? You know, a lot of times, like, yeah, so that's why I would ask them, I would say, well, you know, why do you think in Mexico, like, politicians don't pay attention to you either, right? Because they're saying they don't pay attention to us here, they don't pay attention. They're like, because we're poor. It's the same thing, you know, like, they don't respect us, they don't, you know. And then you can think about the anti-poverty discourses in both countries, right? There's lots of similarities transnationally that these migrants are, you know, engaging, right, and mediating. And then when I thought transnationally with respect to the mostly Filipina immigrant actors, but there was also some Southeast Asian, some Pacific Islander, you know, every time they would talk about their political struggles in the United States, they always tied it to, well, the United States came over to the Philippines, right? And it's not just like about colonization and they oppressed us and they killed us and, you know, overtook us. But, you know, they're like, you know that the U.S. dumps all their tobacco in the Philippines? You know that the U.S. dumps all their electronics and their batteries over in the Philippines, right? So there was no way they could think about their political struggle in the United States without also invoking U.S. and first world power in their Asian home country, right? You know, the same thing, you know, with the Cambodian immigrants, you know, the Pacific Islander, it's all because the U.S. went there first, like bombing the heck out of their country or, you know, basically annexing, like colonizing and annexing their country, right? And so, you know, they would talk about like, yeah, like this, the Simona Morgan actress would say, yeah, the reason they look down on us is because, you know, they always see those as those backward, you know, third world primitives that then came here and all we can do is play football. You know, or, you know, they always see us as those like, you know, war-torn, pathetic peasants in Cambodia, right? And then here, you know, we've been running our whole lives and then, you know, Long Beach won't even let us have our Cambodian New Year's parade in April, you know, because they don't respect us, right? And so that element of transnationality was also really important in another sense, which is that most of the Asian immigrant activists had had some political activist background in their home country, okay? And then came here and then parlayed that political experience with dealing with all these different movements here, right? Most of the Mexican activists had not, just because they felt so shut out of the political process and, you know, felt that they just did not have a voice. So I think that transnational, it's not just the transnational experience politically, but it's also that ongoing political circuits and networks they're in, right, transnationally that matter. And, you know, being literally transnational because you're legal is not something that Latinas can do, right? Most of them are undocumented. They can't be literally transnational where they're going back and forth. Right, so I think that really matters as well for why they're not like necessarily kind of like invoking U.S. or First World or NAFTA or whatever, right, in the home country. I mean, they're just not really seeing it or engaging it or wanting to engage it, right? So that's where transnationality, you know, mattered. I think the most with respect to this in particular too.